Welcome to Classically Current, where we review new films and old films and link them together with your host, Zach
and Kyle.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back once again to our show where we're going to discuss the original 1978 classic Halloween. And we're going to get into a lot of fun and interesting facts and behind the scenes info like we usually do on Classically Current. We just wanted to thank you guys so much for continuing to tune in each and every week. It has been a pleasure to get messages and voice memos from fans of the show and from people asking us to do certain movies, and one of them was Halloween, the 1978 classic. Thank you guys so much for subscribing and rating and reviewing. Those help us all to reach more enthusiastic movie fans in the future. And people ask us, Kyle, what is the best way to message us? And what would you say to them, Kyle?
One way you could message us is by subscribing and then leaving a question, comment, or suggestion on Twitter on our Classically Current One page.
Yes, you can either search Classically Current or there we are at Classically Cur One, so C-U-R and the number one, and that's our Twitter account. We're slowly growing, but we love to get direct messages, or if you want to send a voice memo, you can do it in the details on Apple Podcasts. If you click on details, you just go ahead and you click on the details, and then it'll show you where to send us a voice memo on Anchor. We are also on not just Apple Podcasts, but Spotify, Breaker, CastBox, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Pocket Cast, and Radio Public. So if you guys know anybody that would be interested in our podcast and they have one of those, if they have one of those podcast platforms, go ahead and send them a link. That'd be awesome. But without further ado, let's get into 1978 Halloween and let the podcast begin.
Halloween was released on October 25, 1978, right before Halloween, and the story goes a mental patient by the name of Michael Myers has been committed to a sanitarium for murdering his teenage sister on Halloween night when he was just 6 years old. 15 years later, though, he escapes and returns to his hometown where he stalks a female babysitter and her friends while also under pursuit by his psychiatrist, Dr. Loomis. Here is a trailer clip from the original Halloween.
Michael?
I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil. I think he'll come back.
Exploring uncharted territory.
And totally charted.
Sure.
The only reason she babysits
is
to have
Halloween, the night he came home.
I myself am recording in a different area than I normally am, so if you hear some kittens or cat noises, feel free to just ignore them. We got cats, we got kittens going into my studio right now where I'm recording. So if you hear them, why you can even make a tally and then you can just tell us how many times you hear a cat or a kitten noise at the end. And I mean, we What do you think, Kyle? Should we just give someone a prize if they tell us how many times?
If it tallies over 100, I guess we could maybe give them a prize or something.
If it tallies over 100 kitten or cat noises.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably too much, but hopefully it doesn't do it that much.
I mean, at that point, I may have to just leave. I may have to just record outdoors.
Might as well.
But so please excuse the cat noises that may or may not occur during the recording of this episode. But with that, let's get back to the show. So, this movie, 1978 Halloween, was directed by John Carpenter. John Carpenter is an American film director, producer, screenwriter, as well as composer. Although Carpenter has worked with various film genres, he is usually associated with the horror, action, science fiction films of the 1970s and 80s. And his most successful films are the 1978 Halloween and The Fog, Escape from New York, and Starman. Those were his most successful films. And some of his other ones that are more considered cult classics would be Dark Star, Assault on Precinct 13, The Thing, Christine, Big Trouble in Little China, Prince of Darkness, They Live, and In the Mouth of Madness. He is also a producer on the newest Halloween, which retconned the sequels after the original, and that one came out in 2018, and they're actually making a sequel to that one, which I believe will come out next year, close to Halloween time. John Carpenter's films are mostly characterized by minimalistic lighting and photography, static cameras, as well as the use of Steadicam, and he has distinctive synthesized scores, which he usually composes himself.
Yeah, and none more memorable than Halloween.
I mean, this is probably one of the more memorable scores that I can remember. I mean, you just listen to it one time, it's stuck in your head for days.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned also, too, the use of Steadicam. And that was actually invented in 1975 by Garrett Brown. So this movie came out 3 years after that. So this was one of the first movies that's actually employing the use of the Steadicam. And there's a lot of Steadicam shots throughout this film. I mean, you have, you're going through houses the entire time, interior locations. So it's kind of necessary that they had something like that. But I mean, just some interesting facts from the background of the film. It was actually independent film producer Irwin Yablans and financier Mustafa Akkad that sought out Carpenter to direct a film about a psychotic killer that stalked babysitters. And this came after Carpenter had already done Assault on Precinct 13. Yablans always stated that what he was thinking would make sense in the horror genre was to make a picture that had a similar impact as The Exorcist. And it was going to be cheap to make, so Carpenter actually agreed to direct the film contingent on his having full creative control of it. And he got paid, get this, Zach, $10,000 for his work. And that included, that included the writing, directing, and scoring of the film. So he did literally like everything here in this film. So that he was getting paid $10,000 for is probably, some sort of labor abuse. But he did the most with that money, I'd say.
Well, I mean, the movie itself was such a huge success. I mean, he got repaid tenfold from this movie alone. I mean, $10,000 in 1978 would probably be close to $40,000 today, I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's he's doing a lot of work for one film, and I will get into like how long the shoot was, which it was actually a fairly short shoot, but you're actually, I mean, that takes a lot of planning. You're developing the screenplay, you're developing the score, you're directing actors, you're doing all this stuff, and it's just amazing all the work that he was able to get done on this film.
It sounds like they didn't even have a lot of time to be able to put all this work in place. So I think they literally spent 20 days shooting the film, and it took 10 days just to write the screenplay. So yeah, I mean, everything was just put in motion fast, and like everyone was paid very little. It was a small crew. It was actually Jamie Lee Curtis's first role on film. So a lot of interesting, like, little nuggets in there. And I think Jamie Lee Curtis actually said that this was one of her proudest moments, was being on, you know, a team that's, it really felt like it wasn't like, this is the director, that's the screenwriter, and then that's the cameraman. It was like everybody was working together on this one film, and they were all painting the house in the interior. And, you know, they were all just kind of a team effort, and it's such a small group, and it was able to function, and they did a great job.
Yeah, it's amazing what they were able to accomplish with such a small budget and a small group of people. Speaking of the budget, we'll get into that and the box office success that it had. I mean, the budget itself was between $300,000 to $325,000. You're talking about a $60 to $70 million box office haul. I mean, in the first week, get this, it had 198 theaters across the U.S., and it made over $1.2 million from just 198 theaters across the U.S., and that's, that's pretty impressive. That's in its opening week. It grossed $47 million in the United States and an additional $23 million internationally. But it made, you know, a total of $70 million, or about $70 million worldwide, which would equate to about $267 million when adjusting for inflation. So that made it one of the most successful independent films of all time. And it was the most successful independent film of all time until The Blair Witch Project, which grossed $248.6 million on a $60,000 budget. That is what dethroned Halloween, and that was in 1999, which, I mean, that's a pretty long time to have that much of a record for that amount of time. So that's pretty impressive.
Well, that's interesting too, because yeah, with these low budget films, I mean, that was kind of, Halloween kind of ushered in a new era of horror films, and they did on such a low budget, but brought about the whole slasher flick. And that was, I mean, I would say this is probably the most famous slasher films, in my opinion. It's probably my favorite. And then you had a movie like The Blair Witch Project or movies like Paranormal Activity, and they kind of followed the same model years later with relatively cheap budgets, but, you know, just marketing like crazy. And then, although I do think Halloween was more kind of word of mouth on their marketing, but still, I mean, they made a ton of money, and they got, you know, a lot of money, kind of revenue towards their production companies. I think, what is it? What's the one that he's doing?
You mean Blumhouse?
Blumhouse.
You're talking about Jason Blum. I mean, yeah. They're making their bread and butter off of like really small budget films that turn into huge profits. I mean, they just do it time and time again. They continue to have success with that. It's just amazing what that studio, Blumhouse, has been able to accomplish. They've just had so much success, but they wouldn't have been inspired, I guess you could say, if it wasn't for John Carpenter and Halloween in 1978. This is kind of where it all started.
Yeah, and you know, kind of talking about its initial release, Halloween did perform well with little advertising, as we mostly talked about, but it didn't really go over well with some of the critics at first. A lot of them just kind of cited that it was a copy of Hitchcock or De Palma films at the time. I actually saw more kind of a Dario or Argento kind of vibe with it, but I will say Roger Ebert, who is often a vocal critic of slasher films, did praise this film, citing that it is a visceral experience, and we aren't seeing the movie, but we're having it happen to us. It's frightening. Maybe you don't like movies that are really scary, and don't see this one then. So that is kind of interesting that some of the top critics gave it good scores, but overall it was kind of a mixed bag, it seemed like. And I think that's just kind of the horror genre in general. has kind of always had a negative stigma about it, that maybe they're considered more B movies, and they kind of figured this was another one of those B movie films that just was kind of a way for a director to get his foot in the door.
Yeah, and it seems there's a connection here with like the original Psycho with Alfred Hitchcock, and that came out in 1960 with Janet Leigh starring in that and her daughter starring in this film, and Psycho not really getting very good traction with critics, I feel like, and it had some drama surrounding its release, but then it was really mind-blowing for audiences, and audiences kept going and going to see Psycho, and it was a very successful movie after that. It's kind of similar how this one rolled out too. Critics maybe had mixed feelings, but then it's turned into like a classic film, and it's, you know, earned several $1 million in the box office, and it continues to be shown each year around this time on AMC, you know, the AMC channel. I mean, they're always showing this and their sequels every year. So it's like a tradition
to watch this movie. You like have to go through Halloween movies during Halloween week. And I mean, it did get later acclaim, as you said. It's got a 96% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is very high. And then it's got 87 out of 100 on Metacritic, which is universal acclaim. So it's kind of like a fine wine. It's improved with age.
Yeah, and now that we have talked about some, you know, box office success, critical success, and the movie background, we're going to get into some more fun facts. So we'll just kind of go over this one by one and alternate here, but I'll just start by saying it was interesting, Kyle, that John Carpenter used a fear meter gauge to help Jamie Lee Curtis figure out how scared she should act because the movie was filmed out of sequence. If you watch the movie, the beginning sequence is actually filmed at the end, and so there's several scenes that are kind of all out of order, so John Carpenter had to tell Jamie Lee Curtis on a scale of 1 to 10 how scared she should act in this particular sequence, and that seemed to actually work quite well. I felt like Jamie Lee Curtis's performance was one of the better performances in the movie.
Oh yeah, for a first-time actress, I thought she did a phenomenal job. And it didn't feel necessarily phony or fake, because it did feel like it kind of had more of that progression. Like, it's not escalating too fast. So she did a good job with the... And I think that fear meter's kind of a little interesting nugget that John Carpenter was able to apply, and it just kind of shows his capability with working with the actors to get the performances he needed out of them, especially considering that a lot of them were not real famous, and so you kind of had to make the most of it,
right? But,
speaking of Jamie Lee Curtis, she only made $8,000 for this film. We had said that John Carpenter made $10,000, and then she made only $8,000. And then just to compare that, she got paid $5 million for Halloween H2O.
I mean, the director, the composer, and the writer gets $2,000 more than the star of the movie. That should just tell you all of what you need to know about Hollywood and how actors are paid and the behind the scenes crew are paid. I mean, I get it. It's like a little bit of star power, and Jamie Lee Curtis's performance, you know, made her a huge star because of this film. So she had a very successful career after this. But she did have a rut of movies where she just played the scream queen, as they call it. So, I mean, whether it's good or bad, I don't know. I mean, she seemed to enjoy doing that back then. I mean, I know now she's probably sick of the Halloween franchise, I would think, but she keeps coming back to it. She starred in the most recent one, so I think she'll be back for the next one next year. So,
yeah, you kind of always get the vibe just a little bit in interviews that although she really loved the experience and everything, it did kind of, she felt almost like she's pigeonholed into you know, kind of always being considered that. But I mean, it's unfortunate that it happens to actors, but I think they should also take that as a compliment because they did so well with the original role. But yeah, moving on.
After an early screening of the film, a critic actually complained that it was not very scary. So John Carpenter decided to compose an entire score in just 3 days. So that really iconic score that they have in the film is only took 3 days to compose for him. I mean, that's just amazing. And he got inspiration from a drum beat that his dad had taught him when he was a child. So, I mean, that's interesting right there. He just took inspiration from his childhood and went with it. But
right. Yeah. I think it uses like a 5/4 time signature too. And it's just kind of crazy how genius can happen in such a little amount of time on just a whim of an idea. But as we said, it was done on short notice. It took less than 2 weeks to write the script for Halloween. The original title was actually supposed to be called The Babysitter Murders, which actually sounds pretty frightening itself, doesn't it, Zach?
I mean, it's not as iconic as the Halloween title, but, you know, that title in itself is kind of chilling, and it kind of makes sense with what is happening in the movie.
Yeah, I do think it would have made it kind of it kind of has a more B-movie sound to it. I think Halloween is a little more grand on the big scale, so I think it was appropriate change.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting, the production and the background of this movie, because Halloween, while it is set in Haddonfield, Illinois in the movie, it is actually shot in Pasadena and Hollywood in California. And so if you look closely in the movie, you can see palm trees in the background in some shots. You can see there's a lot of greenery because they're actually filming this in the springtime. And John Carpenter wanted them to try to make all the trees look autumn-like via fake leaves. And they did do fake leaves in some scenes, but they just didn't have the budget to make everything look autumn-like, so that was unfortunate. But
so the mask for Michael Myers was kind of originally described as having the pale, neutral face features of a man, and one way they achieved this was by borrowing a Captain Kirk mask from Star Trek, and that mask was $1, and all they did was paint the face white, took off the sideburns, the eyebrows, and messed the hair up, and voila, there was your Michael Myers mask.
Well, yeah, it's just such an iconic mask, and for it to just be kind of like a cheap $2 mask, it's kind of funny, but that's just kind of what they had to do. And moving on to some other fun facts, Donald Pleasance, who played Dr. Sam Loomis, we just talked about a little while ago about a connection between Psycho and this film, and it's interesting because John Carpenter named the character Sam Loomis after the character in Psycho, which was Janet Leigh's boyfriend. His name was Sam Loomis, and in this film, Sam Loomis is the character that is trying to save Laurie Strode, who is Janet Leigh's daughter, Jamie Lee Curtis. So it's an interesting connection there. And they were trying to get other actors to do the role, like Christopher Lee or Peter Cushing, but they didn't take the role because it was it wasn't paying enough for them, I guess. So Sam Loomis, Donald Pleasance, he ended up doing like 4 Halloween sequels, which concluded with Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, which was released after his death in 1995.
Yeah, and touching on Christopher Lee real quick, he actually, I believe, stated that was his biggest regret, is not taking the role in Halloween. Most of Halloween's main cast provided their own wardrobe. Curtis bought her costumes at JCPenney, all for under $100.
And it's interesting, Kyle, Michael Myers is played by 3 different actors. One of them is Nick Castle, who was John Carpenter's friend from USC Film School. And one of them, who was actually unmasked at the end, Tony Moran, would go on to appear in guest spots on TV shows like The Waltons and Chips. And he was paid $250 for a day's work and a single shot in Halloween. I mean, that's not bad for a day's work right there.
No, but I thought I'd heard somewhere that Nick Castle was only getting $25 a day.
Wow.
And I guess Moran was only used for one day, so they gave him a little bit more. But yeah, Nick Castle actually was also a director. He's done Dennis the Menace, Zach. That's a fun little fact there for you.
I didn't realize that. I had heard, and he helped write Escape from New York. I had heard about that, but I didn't know he did Dennis the Menace. But
he directed that as well. So, Zach, when did you actually see this movie?
This movie, I had actually just seen bits and pieces over the years on TV. It would always play on AMC, and I would always check out what was on there every year for the past 5 or 6 years or so. I never really was into horror films. Kyle is more into the horror genre, and I have never really gotten into that myself. But this was one of my introductions into the slasher subgenre, you could say, and I was always creeped out and amazed by the uneasiness that you felt when the what we were talking about earlier, the tracking shots, the Steadicam, the point of view shots at the beginning with the child going into the house and creepily going up to his sister's room, and that one scene was pretty creepy, and it just sets the tone for the entire film about Michael Myers. And you know, it was interesting reading about John Carpenter and his intentions with that beginning scene. He wanted to make this movie, which was a small budget movie, he wanted to make it look like a big budget production, and that is one of the things they did, is use the Steadicam to make it look a little bit more advanced. And it worked to perfection in this movie, where you have a lot of these shots that are creepily going along the streets of Haddonfield. And it really builds the tension and suspense throughout when you have these shots. Because some shots, there's nobody there. Some shots, you can see his face. He uses lighting. He uses, you know, shadows to creepily get the sense of Michael Myers' presence and the breathing. I mean, it just works very well in creating that atmosphere that's going for. But I originally watched it on TV, and I actually just watched it for the first time unedited, and it's actually a lot better, I think, unedited. I think you get more of the, when you're watching a movie on TV, especially a scary movie, the tension is just completely released when there are commercial breaks. It just does not give the movie justice. And when you're actually watching it as a whole, it's a lot more of what the filmmaker intended, and therefore it makes the film more creepy as you go along.
Yeah, I do feel like they should cut out advertising in movies in general, but for TV movies anyways, but that's the name of the game. But yeah, I remember when I saw this, being pretty young, I don't even think I was 10. I watched a lot of scary movies and a lot of movies that I probably wasn't supposed to be watching. It's what it drew me. I've always compared a lot of the other slasher films to, you know, Halloween, just because it impacted me so much when I was little. But yeah, I've always enjoyed the original movie. I've actually always enjoyed the sequels as well. I know they get kind of a bad rap, and they're probably never going to equate to the original. But yeah, I started at a young age watching a lot of these horror films. And this one certainly left a lasting impression on me. I've probably seen it, I don't even want to know how many times I've probably seen it, Zach. It would probably be borderline crazy of me.
what is it about this movie that makes you kind of revisit it each year?
Well, I think I've always found Michael Myers just to be a fascinating person, even though there's really no, it doesn't dig in too deep on his character or anything of that nature. I think it's more just the mystery of him. Like, you talked about how you see shots with, you know, people in it and then people aren't in it. And that's kind of what it is with him. Like, he's in some shots and then he's not there in other shots. He's like this constant, mysterious thing that can just disappear out of thin air. Actually, Zach, have you ever seen those videos where they say, with shows like whenever Michael Myers is off camera, whenever he's not being filmed, it's like shows him like running as fast as he can to get to the next spot. And then once he's back on camera, he's like playing it all cool and slow because you're just,
oh man,
your mind is blown that he can get somewhere so fast by only ever walking. I think that's
the
other thing.
We got to put that in the show notes so everybody can see. That is so funny.
Yeah, that's
and it's funny, especially in this movie, because he is like this supernatural death machine, this slasher machine, really. And you don't really understand. He doesn't. Yeah, he's just unstoppable. You don't really understand his connection with Lori, though. I mean, I feel like he's just drawn to her for what reason. Or for one reason or another, you don't really get a sense of what that is.
I was going to say, too, like, just another iconic scene, like one that will always be imprinted in my mind, was when he pegs that guy on the wall and then he just kind of stares at him like for several seconds. Like, the camera's just, and there's no music. Like, that's one of the few scenes where the music is not playing in the background. And it's just like this really creepy, eerie vibe to it that was so effective, I thought.
It's one of those that just definitely stays with you when you watch it.
Yeah, those were some of my positives. There's a lot to like about this film. As far as any negatives, I kind of rewatching it, I do feel like the movie is almost too short to the point where it's less effective. And that we're not really always building up the suspense long enough, or I just feel like it could be extended, or we could know more of the characters in the background. And then there are, you know, certain actors outside of Donald Pleasance and Jamie Lee Curtis that I thought were kind of meh, not the best acting, I would say. But
yeah, I mean, that's where my negatives kind of start there. And it is noticeable when you're watching it.
Yeah,
outside of Donald Pleasance, like you said, and Jamie Lee, which I felt like she was one of the better parts of the movie. But those ancillary characters, her friends, are just like these caricature teenagers. And I should have done a word count on the word totally in this movie. I mean,
I know.
It's just mind-numbing how many
times.
Like,
was that a big thing in 1978? You totally never showed. Like, they are, like, yeah, it just seems kind of ridiculous. Just almost over the top, too cliche.
That must have been a popular phrase in the 1978. I mean,
but like, she's supposed to be the what's her friend's name? The total ditz, though, is like, it's just hard to watch on screen.
Yes, she has some cringeworthy lines and some acting, as well as the curly hair friend. I can't remember her name, but she has some as well. There's some effective scares that these. I feel like one of the more effective scares was when, like you said, one of the teenager's boyfriends was up against the wall. Michael Myers had already taken care of him, and then he goes upstairs in a ghost costume with the boyfriend's glasses on, and she's like wanting him to come to bed, and he's just not saying anything. And then she's like upset at him for not saying anything, and then she calls Lori. And then there's this sequence where she's
so dumb,
which is kind of dumb, but it's kind of brilliant at the same time. She's on the phone and Lori thinks she is making some kind of squealing noise. Yes. And it is so kind of awkward to watch, but I mean, Lori knows this person and she just thinks that she's playing tricks on her, while Michael Myers is kind of creepily watching her and using the phone against her. But it all culminates at the end when all of those three people end up showing up at that old abandoned house when Lori is trying to find them, and those three characters make an appearance at the end. And that's a pretty frightening scene there as well, where Michael Myers had taken everybody into that house. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's the tombstone.
That tombstone. I don't even remember that from the times I watched it on TV, but that was another creepy part of the movie as well. And so I think it has a pretty good buildup, and everything kind of culminates at the end. And Michael Myers is like this, like we said, this freak of nature. He doesn't slow down. He gets shot like 5-6 times towards the end there, and he still just gets up and you don't know where he is. Away. He's just out there. And then I love the ending shots where you have just this the musical score is playing and you have this breathing in and out, and it's just going through all of the scenes at the end of the movie. It goes through all the scenes that had happened previously, all the locations,
all the damage that was done.
Damage that was done, all the neighborhood shots, and it's just him breathing, just letting you know that he's still there. He's still
you don't alive see him and ready. You just see what he has done, the damage he's done, and you just hear his breathing. Yeah, I thought that was very effective there.
One of the things we do on Classic Current is connect the new movies with the old movies. And so we were just going to talk about that briefly, because we just recently watched Hubie Halloween, and that inspired us to go back to revisit the 1978 Halloween. So, Kyle, what kind of similarities do you feel the Hubie Halloween has with the original Halloween?
Well, one of the opening scenes of Hubie Halloween is kind of takes place at a psych ward. And then we discover that a psych patient has escaped. And you kind of get it from the get-go that, oh, this is kind of a homage to Halloween. And so this psych patient is going back to his hometown. And that's kind of where it ends in, to some extent. But there is still a continuation of that story a little bit. And that this psych patient does go back home, but he's not, you know, the actual killer. And you have, you know, police officers that are on search for him, and they are trying to locate this patient to get him back. And
right. And you also have like the teenagers in this movie, like the obviously in Hubie Halloween, people get captured, but they don't really get harmed. But in the original Halloween, obviously you have some teenagers that are having some risque behavior, and they're the ones that end up biting the dust in the original Halloween. And then Hubie Halloween, it's the kids that are doing the bullying. It's the kids that are, it's the people that are messing with Hubie that are getting captured. And in the end, they have to kind of have that reckoning in the Hubie Halloween. So it's kind of similar in that way.
Yeah, so it kind of is a lesson learned for both.
Yeah, and that's interesting because 1978 Halloween kind of started the final girl trope that has been developed, where it's kind of spoofed in the movie Cabin in the Woods, where the virgin is the one that survives and everybody else who is...
right, anybody that engages in sexual activity dies.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, it's definitely an attempt probably to maybe keep kids from being promiscuous. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say so.
At least
I mean, you don't
marriage,
really get these know. Types of you don't really get these types of slasher movies as much anymore. I don't feel like. Yeah.
Well, I think John Carpenter actually said that wasn't really his intended use for it, like as don't engage in, you know, sexual activity before marriage. Like he just said it kind of ended up that way. Just based on the premise of the film itself.
Right, and the movie itself became so iconic and people watch it so many times. It's like, and then they started copying off of that same kind of formula. Yeah. So it's interesting that maybe that wasn't his intention, but it spanned generation of film goers and horror fans, that trope. So that's interesting. But
yeah, and plus, I mean, you have a film like that too that's become so iconic over the years. Everyone wants to... draw their own opinions on what this means and what that means. When really, I mean, you think about this movie was written in like 10 days and it was filmed in 20 days. Like, I don't know if they, I don't want to say they kind of didn't take time and effort into really coming up with a thought behind it, but I think people will sometimes read more into something like that than what is really intended to be. I don't know. That's my opinion, I guess.
So, what would you say, Kyle, is your final review and your recommendation?
Oh boy, I think I don't know. Watching this over again, it's less and less scary to me. It's never been scary, but I've always enjoyed watching it, and I always go back to watch it. So it's something I always have to revisit at least once a year around Halloween time. This is probably an 8.5 for me. Yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect movie by any means. The acting is somewhat inconsistent throughout. I thought besides Jamie Lee Curtis and Donald Pleasance, but it's an effective film. Like, for something that had such a small budget, I thought the scares were pretty legitimate. Even though I kind of know what's lurking around every corner since I've seen it so many times. But yeah, I give it 8.5, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this film, it's something that I've appreciated over the years as I've kind of watched it more and more as of, you know, starting watching it bits and pieces and then watching it as a whole. And obviously, we kind of touched on some of the things that were flaws with it. So it's like a flawed masterpiece, I guess you could say, or a masterclass yes. in how to build tension and how to use your resources. I mean, they used such a small budget with wardrobe. All the cast members actually, you know, bought their own wardrobes for most of film. And
Zach, think how amazing it was that they were able to make Pasadena, California in the springtime look like Illinois in the fall. I mean, that took some effort too, just for a small budget and a little amount of time.
I mean, it just shows the craftsmanship and the amount of work that was on display. And I mean, that's a lot of hard work to make an independent movie. You're just starting off your career. Like you said, he had made Assault on Precinct 13 before this, but this is like really the one that kind of jump-started a lot of other films of John Carpenter's. But it's just one of those that's really special because of the amount of work that they put into it to make it look realistic and the effectiveness of the Steadicam shots and the creativity of that and how he was able to build tension and suspense. And by the way, he made one of the more iconic villainous characters, a face of villainy and evil in Michael Myers, out of anything in the zeitgeist, in the American zeitgeist right now. So kudos to him and the actors, Jamie Lee and Donald Pleasance, for making it an interesting film and an interesting film franchise. I would give this I would say an 8 out of 10. I mean, obviously it's not perfect, but its imperfections kind of overlooked because of the fun that you have with it. And I was pretty scared watching this the first time I saw it, but like you said, after I watched it this time, I was not as creeped out or scared by it per se, but I was able to see some of the tricks that he was using to make things more scary or tension-filled. I mean, he mix and matches a lot of different things to keep the tension going, and it doesn't seem to mimic himself too much and make it kind of stale. I felt like it stayed fresh throughout for the most part.
Yeah, I think for me the number one thing too is in a film is I want to feel it. I want to be able to experience it. I always like atmosphere in movies, and I'm usually willing to overlook, you know, something that could be viewed as mediocre acting in place for very effective atmosphere and tension throughout, and that's what this movie gives me, and that's why I give it as high of a score as I do. It's just because it's impacted me for so long, and will continue to do so. And it spurred a new generation of horror too.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in once again to Classically Current. We have some other reviews coming up next week because our shows release at 10 a.m. on Friday. Each Friday, we are releasing a podcast episode at 10 a.m. So tune in next week as we are going to review Borat 2, which comes out on Amazon Prime October 23rd. And we're going to review that movie and have a good time, as well as review the original Borat and see how the political landscape has changed from, I believe that was it 2006 or so when the Borat came out, and then 2020 now. So it'll be interesting to see the comparisons and review those films one by one. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Classically Current.
If you like this, please be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcast so that you will never miss a show.
And if you found value in our show, we'd love it if you gave us a review so we can continue to grow and reach more enthusiastic movie fans in the future.
Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too.
Be sure to check out our Twitter account, Classically Current, to receive film and entertainment news as well as updates on our show.
Thanks again for joining us.
Stay classy.
And stay current.